everyone. Welcome to our event. This event is brought to you by DataDogs Club, which is a community of people who love data. We have weekly events, and today is one of such events. If you want to find out more about the events we have, there is a link in the description. Click on that link and you'll see what we have in our pipeline, which I don't think is a lot right now, but we will be adding more events in the future. So keep an eye on that link. Do not forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. This way you will stay up to date. You will get notified with all the future streams we have. And do not forget to join our data community in Slack, where you can hang out with other data enthusiasts. So this week we will talk about knowledge graphs and LLMs and how they are used and research in academia and industry. And we have a very special guest today. Anahita is originally from Iran. She transitioned from mechanical engineering and specialized in applied mechanics in Sweden, then worked in automotive industry for 5 years. Then she shifted focus to pursuing a PhD in applied AI in Germany. Yeah, she combined her love for life and learning with a passion for cognitive sciences. Yeah, as always, the questions for today's interview are prepared by Johanna Bayer. Thanks, Johanna, for your help. And welcome, Anahita, to our interview.
Hello. Thanks for the invite and help. And also thanks for the intro. It was covering great.
And before we go into our main topic of knowledge graphs, LLMs, and all that, let's start with your background. I briefly mentioned your background, but probably you can go a little bit more details. So can you tell us about your career journey so far?
Yeah, it was always a bit tricky to know what is the next step. But I could, as a summary, you said it perfect, as studying mechanical engineering. It was, I think I really loved math, but I wanted to be practical. So that's like how you end up to being engineer, I would say, basically. And then I moved to Sweden because I was really curious to study a bit more and be a, because in the bachelor, I really felt I didn't learn much. I didn't really feel to be an engineer. And that's like why I went into the applied mechanics, to really feeling it, that it's, you can use it in a different analysis. And then I started working, and being living in Gothenburg, it's a bit hard to be out of automotive industry. So I started, everything was quite random, I would say, with a bit of higher probability. And then starting at the automotive industry, it's a lot of demand on automation. And I was really lucky to be in this company because it was a lot of unestablished coding and automation. So usually you don't get this chance of doing a lot of coding in companies as a start, a graduate, a fresh graduate. And then a lot of code. And also the plan was that after a couple of years, I would pick the topic that is interesting for my PhD. But I thought it would be 2 years. But after 2 years, I had no clue what PhD I want to do it. And then after 4 years, I figured, okay, maybe I'm looking in the wrong domain, because I spend most of my time in optimization, in automation, and a lot of semantic reporting for the company. Then I dare to feel that, okay, maybe I should move toward computer science and data science. And that's when I started to shape my PhD proposal. And I had a tough time to get funding in Sweden. And that's why it took me to Germany to work in front of a sky in the topic I like to do my PhD. Of course, semantic reporting, the next step was it for that, to have a knowledge graph for crash simulations.
What do actually mechanical engineers do in applied mechanics?
The program is so focused on finite element analysis and CFD. And so it's like you small break down the physics into small elements and then try to find the behavior of them. I mean, in a really basic explanation. So you have a lot of different physics that you want to predict the behavior. And then you try to use different equations to find what is the response to that change, to a force, to a vibration, to a flow of fluids, or to a deformation of a crash as well.
I guess the application of this would be in automotive industry, like the designing of a car, right?
Yeah, for sure. So like before, in the past, it was making a lot of prototypes, physical prototypes, and doing the test. And since they were really wanted to shorten the development and also save a lot of money, because making prototype is a lot more expensive than building a real car. And then they are one of the leading industry in using finite element analysis. So like, for example, truck developments or any other developments, they are far, far behind compared to automotive because of the high demand of these kind of analysis.
There's a system with, I don't know, different moving parts, and then you want to change one of the parts of the system, and you want to predict the behavior after this change, right? And this is what you...
It's usually not like that. So you come with a design, so you say, okay, I want to have a car looking like this, and then you say that I want to have these performances, and then you try to, for example, ourselves, to see how we could fulfill all the requirements. So they're usually... the surface or the target of the market, really defining how we should do the improvements. And so usually it comes with a targeted direction of the performance.
So this finite element analysis, is it in any way related to machine learning, or it's a totally different thing?
You could say it's still numerical analysis, so it's not unrelated to differential equations, but you are not solving it based on cost functions and data. So that's the different thing. So you try to model the behavior and predict it. So you really, a lot of investment, a lot of focus is on developing good material model to do the prediction.
So this is what you studied. And then you said there was no way for you to avoid the automotive industry. And you were doing optimization and semantic reporting. What are these things? Like, what kind of optimization you were doing? What kind of, what is semantic reporting?
For with the semantic reporting, what I'm referring to is that, like, it's an interesting topic to have, like, fair data. I mean, to be able to regenerate the analysis, because what is seen in ahead of these all of tests and crash tests is that you don't need to do any physical tests anymore. So it's kind of that on a release of vehicle, maybe you release a model of finite elements and then all the tests will be done. And I don't know if you know, for example, of these tests are UN cap. So when a vehicle comes to the market, you really need to rate the vehicle or you need to pass some legal requirements to have it sellable on the market.
So videos where they put mannequins inside a car and then the car drives to wall and then there's a video...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like a lot of sensor measurements, looking at the injuries on the occupant, on the driver, and so on. So the main measure is actually the injuries, exactly. So from the reporting, so I was in this point that we need to be able to re-evaluate, regenerate the results that we are reporting. And for that aspect, it was like also within analysis, we generate a lot of simulations. Like, for example, for one vehicle, it could be more than 500 simulations, and with this semantic reporting was main focus on reusing the data and a long run to be able to regenerate the results. Because like one crash simulation could have like 12 million elements, and then it could take around overnight analysis, like 17 hours on like 192 CPUs. So it's really costly analysis. And with that, with these semantics was like really classifying all the measures we have, like the sensor data and barriers and so on, to be able to compare the results. So like in the past, it was like generating PowerPoint and Excel sheets. So it was a lot of scripts that were auto-generating the PowerPoints, but still you really couldn't compare. And with the comparison, I have seen, say, engineers putting two PowerPoint that are generated with scripts and try to compare curve. So that's a like one of the real change was that you can click analysis and you can overlay all the sensor data. And after that, within knowledge graph coming from the semantic reporting is to find the patterns in those. And within optimization is like a lot of time within engineering, you try to change thicknesses or adding holes and so on. So it was like trying to use these geometrical changes to be optimized to the behavior we required. What will be, so it's like a lot of topology optimization and the designs. So, for example, for pedestrian analysis, one of the main components that is really important is the inner hood, that because you hit the head there, and then it's like how to cut the mass and have a still a good stiffness, but not so hard for if you crash to a pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And that's the target of the optimization.
Mm-hmm. And all of that happens on a computer, right?
Yes.
So you don't do, like, I assume you don't actually crash into pedestrians to see.
No, luckily not. But it's all of these are also a bit of try to model it. So also in a computer, we don't really hit on a pedestrian. So we have a head or we have a leg impact. There are sensors in them to measure the accelerations to see if this is okay or not. And then after a while, we still do a really physical test, but not on a real pedestrian, so on this model of head or leg, to evaluate how good our modelings are.
I understand why it's called reporting, but why it's semantic reporting?
Because you define, like with this, defining all these measures. So it's kind of modeling of data behind it. So like before that is just, it's also a bit of semantics on those generating the PowerPoints, but still to be able to compare these simulations, you need to have semantics to connect different analysis together.
Yeah, I think I more or less have a picture in mind. So yeah, there are different experiments. Yeah, so these experiments could be related. So for example, there could be like, I don't know, maybe can you give an example of two experiments that are related? Could be like we are in a car and there is we want to see, like we want to hit the wall and see how much the driver is injured, but another experiment is how much the person who is sitting nearby is injured, right? So this could be two different experiments that are related.
No, it's really sensitive analysis, I would say. So with these relations, we small staying a really, really much smaller changes. So it could be that, for example, we make a lot of impact points on the hoods and to see how good the performance of the whole vehicles. And they are usually, for example, with distance of 100 millimeter. So quite small still. And then one of these relations could be that, like, how much the area around it, like, for example, if it's small, slide a bit on the impact, how much robust is that and how much they are still staying with the same behavior of the acceleration, because acceleration curves, they are really sensitive. They could, it's also hard to model them to get a correct acceleration curve. So I would say from driver to passenger, it's a lot of change to say how much they relay, because most of vehicles are not really symmetric either. Mm-hmm. With, like, you have an engine there and you have like a cooler there. So it's a lot of, we try to have a symmetric intrusion, but it's really tricky still to have it. And in a real life, most of the impacts are not symmetric either.
Do I understand correctly that this is something you started doing while still working at the automotive industry? And then this is what led you to do graphs now?
Yes,
research. Exactly. Like you were talking that about these impact points that are close to each other, right? And this means that you can build a graph of all these sensors, right? Or impact points somehow.
Yeah.
And this is how you arrive at the graph?
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is also like when I was trying to develop this web-based reporting or semantic reporting, since it was many analysis, it was really old-fashioned, old web technology. And then it was quite necessary to have a backend and a database to improve the performance and also front-end. And at that time, when we started to decide what kind of database we need to use, and we decided to skip relational databases. And that's like, I would say, when looking into graph databases started, because automotive industry has so many changes that if you want to have a relational database, it's really time consuming to maintain it. It's like when I started with my company, we were looking into implementing data management systems, because this is like an old topic within automotive, to maintain the part, because like one vehicle has a lot of different parts, a lot of different models, how to connect these, like the input data, how to be related. And they are looking into relational databases and like to really establish it, it's time consuming. So that's why my mentor advised to use this Neo4j or any other graph databases. that is where you started. But it's not also easy to just store crash simulations or any FE analysis in a graph database because you can't store all the data.
I'm trying to visualize this graph. I don't think I can. What are the nodes? What are the edges in this graph? What kind of relationships can we model there?
Mm-hmm.
If we talk about semantic reporting.
Yeah. So like one basic start is like that you refollow the R&D development. So like from a vehicle that is supposed to be on the market, and if we stay with crash, because it could be any different analysis and requirements like durability and so on. Within the crash, we know what is the year of the release of the vehicle, and then what are the required performance. So this is like some kind of semantics to connect the current vehicle to the vehicles on the markets and be able to aim. So kind of benchmarking to see how we could perform. So like from the weight of the vehicle, size of the vehicle, and so on. And then coming from vehicles, then one vehicle that has, it has like a platform and also upper body of like how the vehicle looks like. And then in this, so it's like really capturing the structure of the company, how they are developing, because these relations also help to relay the analysis and the behaviors. So why, for example, this platform and upper body is important is because you could compare the siblings' vehicles. So you see the cars that look like the same, but they have different ride height or a bigger trunk size or stuff. These vehicles are still could be related. And it was a topic of interest to see if we could predict simulations based on one platform and upper body to another platform and upper body. And if we go a bit more detailed between simulations, it was like to convert the physics of the problem to a graph. So like what is really important from a crash simulation engineers to detect a behavior of a crash, to say this simulation is similar to another simulation from this analysis.
So while you were talking, I was taking notes and then I drew a graph. So mm-hmm. In this graph, I have a node with year when the car was made, let's say 2020. This is the year. And then we can have nodes of individual cars, and the connection between the car and 2020 could be the year when it's made. Then the body type or upper body type, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then I guess there are other different characteristics of a car, right? And all of these are nodes. And each car is also a node, and the relationship between the nodes, the edges is like, okay, made in, type of the body, or I don't know, engine type, like different characteristics, different features.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And why is it a useful representation? Because if I think about machine learning, so in machine learning, quite often we have tabular data, right? And then it could be, we can have rows. Each row would be an experiment. And then we can have different features, right? Features could be year, type of the body, upper body, type of the engine, other things. And the result, like the target, the thing we want to predict could be, I don't know, what do we usually predict? Like impact on the person or on the pedestrian or whatever, right? Why do we actually need graphs here? What can we not express with a table?
I mean, a lot of things that you have it as a graph, you can express it with table, but then it's mostly on abstraction that is nice, and also into finding a bit more complex relations between them. So, for example, one of the main gains I have in my PhD is to have a visualization that you can have a look over 300 simulations. So if you want to compare 300 simulations in a table with visual look, I think it would be a bit tricky. And with like using weighted graph and visualizing the simulations and then their parts that have been involved mostly in the crash, was simply clustering the simulations and also showing what are the important parts for those crash simulation or what is the common parts in those. And also like, for example, to detect a load pass. So it's like when you really transfer the physics of the problem into the graph, you can also answer different questions like load pass detection. So it's like load pass is like where is the, if you transfer a structure of the vehicle to a graph, And like each part is one node. And then if they are connected, they have an edge between them. So connected to another part. And then you try to get the how much each part has absorbed or been involved in a crash. And then you try to find what is the main path of the load transfer within the structure. So kind of the longest path use. And that is also a highlight that I don't know of a way to really see it in a table.
So that's what you do in your PhD research, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And as I understood, so you have a system, it's based on Neo4j, and then you have different graphs, and then, you have a graph, different nodes, and then it allows you to do this exploration. So you can click on the node, and then, let's say we want to look at cars that were made in 2020, then you can maybe click on the 2020 node and then explore different models and how they perform in experiments, right?
Yeah.
And see all these load passes or paths and other things, right?
That's a bit of, I would say, some part of this knowledge graph is in data engineering. And I think most of the thing you can do within knowledge graph, maybe I am not really that experienced to comment it, but I feel you can also do it with a relational database. It's just a lot of overhead of maintenance and so on between these two. But what is quite interesting for myself is that when you can extract a computational graph from a knowledge graph and then do further analysis on that. And these that I referred to, they are mostly on graph data science, specifically compared to a knowledge graph.
So knowledge graph is, so we have a car. So the parts of the car, they have different relationships between each other. So they are connected. And then all these sensors, then also different characteristics of a car, like here, type of the upper body, all these things. So this is the knowledge graph, right?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the node degrees there. So you can do a query there. So what are other cars related to this one? What are the parts? And so on. So you can do a lot of query.
So this is how we express what we know about the cars, but then we do this simulation, right? Crash simulation, and somehow also record the results in this graph, or how
exactly?
Does...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the computational graph that we have. I think I don't understand what is the computational graph.
So we have the knowledge graph that includes a lot of simulations. So it's like it holds the market, different cars, but then it also have a lot of simulations of that vehicle included. And then we pick, for example, simulations and parts as the input data. And then we make like a graph, like Network X graph or whatever of graph data science. And then that is the one I'm calling the computational graph.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's not related to FE analysis directly anymore. So it's just graph data science.
Yeah, and what do you actually mean by graph data science or machine learning? What kind of things you can do with these graphs? So you mentioned NetworkX, which is a library in Python, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which can work with graphs. So once we express this graph in NetworkX, what can we do with this?
One is like predicting the similarity of the simulations, or like this longest path analysis I told you, or a lot of visualizations. Because like when you load the whole knowledge graph, to, for example, having this as a weighted graph, and especially it's also not easy to have weight on all the edges, then it will be a bit tricky to have a good visualization. So that's why I call it like a computational graph, that you always look at the part of your whole knowledge graph to visualize it and find the pattern. But it's still the whole data is coming from the knowledge graph.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, so you mentioned that graph data, you mentioned two terms, graph data science and graph machine learning. So if I understand correctly, the distinction here is like in one case, it's more like doing some sort of analytics, right? Or doing this analysis, exploring the graph. And in the other case, making predictions. Well, what's the difference between these two?
I think graph data science and graph machine learning are the same. So it's like saying, what's the difference of data science and machine learning? They are same, different, I would say.
Okay. So what kind of things you can, you mentioned actually things that we can do, but I'm curious when it comes to machine learning, like when it comes to predicting something. Yeah, we can see if two things are similar using different similarity metrics. They are more like graph similarity metrics. Yeah, I don't remember, I remember that there are different measures
It's like SimRank is the method I use. So that's like items that are referred by similar items are similar. And that's like how you predict the similarities of items. Because you really don't have any ranking for the simulation similar. So you give us the input, for example, one simulations and rank what are the related other analysis to that.
So it's more like unsupervised machine learning. So here you don't really have
exactly.
a target. Okay, I see. And then like your task is to understand the similarity and you use different, in your case, it's SimRank to understand how similar two experiments are, two simulations are.
Yeah.
Do you use any supervised machine learning?
I tried a part of it, and that was on a really, really small toy example, so not really on a complete vehicle. And that was what I relate to siblings' vehicles. So when you have the same, the idea was that, for example, when we have a one platform but two different vehicles, to be able to predict the behavior of them. And that was like that I had a toy FE model, and then I was trying to see if I have a set of data, a development tree, that means that your simulations are related based on the changes, because you always do a small change. So for example, you pick one part and do a thickness change, you pick another part and do a hole, adding a hole in that. So considering this tree and then the physical changes relation to see if we could transfer these behaviors to another sibling vehicle. And with that, it means that the design changes are the same. It's just the impact mass is different. So, and that means we have more kinetic energy in that one. And like, since we are in a high nonlinearity with crash deformations, it's like when you add a lot of more mass in that, you increase the deformations and it's really get hard and are harder when the difference of this mass is huge. But in a smaller level, it was quite interesting results. But still, since we had limited number of simulations, because I wanted to have it like connected to reality, maybe you have max 300 simulations that you want to transfer it. And so what I was doing and was quite interesting, it was pair learning. So I was trying to use the connection of simulations and use the relation of the edges between the relations to predict the level of absorption.
Do I understand correctly that graphs give us not only the way of expressing knowledge, storing knowledge in them, but also when it comes to actually making the simulations, we can also express like each a node could be a different experiment and the connection between them and each would be the change that we make, right? Somehow. Because like if you make a small change, these two experiments are quite related. And then you can observe, you can also express that, you can express that in the graph database that these are very related. There was only one small change between these two experiments. And also you can record the outcome.
Yeah.
This change. Which would be quite difficult in a tabular database, I guess.
Yes.
It would be, like I imagine if I again talk about tabular format, it would be, I guess, changing one of the features and then seeing what happens at the end.
I think in this scenario, it could also be that you could, because we were looking at simulations versus compared to all of the simulations, so you can still think you have it kind of tabular in that framework. But I think what was quite interesting is that when the simulations have an edge real connection, we know they are closer than the one. So like it's kind of additional information in having development tree included.
And you also work on LLMs, right? And you see how these knowledge graphs or graphs are and LLMs can work together. So can you tell us more about that?
I think it's quite a niche topic now with LLMs and knowledge graphs. And that's really focused in text data. And with my PhD, I really didn't focus much on text data NLP. So that's like it's a quite new journey for me. It started from summer after the bootcamp that I did some more of LLMs. And within LLMs and knowledge graph, a lot of focus is on grounding the answer. So it's like really in this part of hallucination of LLMs and to see how you could feed in indexes that will make more reliable answers. It's also, I think, a quite fun domain because I think a lot of people again say knowledge graph and LLMs, but it's also a lot, I feel graph data science is also could support it because on this selecting what is the most similar node to feed in from a knowledge graph to LLMs, it could be also relations that comes from graph data science on edge predictions and so on.
Well, to be honest, I still didn't really understand the connection. So LLMs work on text data and graphs work on graph data, on nodes and edges. And does it mean that, okay, we have different features or characteristics of our experiments, of cars or whatever, which are text-based, and we can use LLMs for these features? Or how does exactly the connection look like?
Yeah, I mean, one of the funny examples was that like this, the questions that LLMs can't answer. So one of them is like, I think it was like person A gave birth to her child in Canada, and then the father was there. No, what was it? I don't remember the example really good. The thing is, what I wanted to, I now should come up with my own example because I don't remember that, it would be a bit fun. But the thing is that like within the relations you have within the, because when we do LLMs, we have a part of text, like we do a chunks in them. And then based on these chunks, you don't have all the data connections to each other. And since also LLMs are not good into having huge amount of input together, then we would miss some of these relations of data to each other. And the thing is that when we build knowledge graph based on the text data, we are transferring, we are generating semantics and add those relations in the knowledge graph. So, and based on that, you could feed into LLM. So it's a bit more of prompt engineering in that direction, that what you should feed in to get the good answers from LLM. So within knowledge graphs, you feed in some more of relations. So for example, with this example that I was trying to say is that, for example, you don't know about who is the mother of a child, for example, but when you have the relations of the people in a graph and transfer that and get all the chunks of information about the mother and the father and the child itself, you enrich the data to answer the questions.
Do I understand it correctly that we have a piece of text that expresses different relationships between entities? And what we use an LLM for is actually extracting these relationships from the text. And then once these relationships are extracted, we can put them in the graph and then use a graph database or a graph library to further analyze the relationship we extract. No?
This is just use of LLM with vector databases. So you make chunks, and for each chunk, you use LLM to do embedding to extract features, and then you store them in the vector database.
I see.
And this is like you have the chunk base. So like you don't have any knowledge graph on that. Mm-hmm. But when it's one of the basic one is that, for example, to build a knowledge graph on that, is that, for example, you are getting a book, and instead of having just these, for example, 400 tokens stored in a node, you also have what are the chapters of the book. So you store the chapters as extra nodes, and then you say, for example, chapter 2 owns these chunks. And then you also add the relation that these chapters come after the other chapter. So you, when you are just having chunks in a vector database, you are missing the relations.
Uh-huh. I think I'm getting it.
And also you are missing the semantics. So these two are coming, these extra relations and semantics are coming with knowledge graph.
So now I think I understood what you said. So you mentioned prompt engineering. And when we come up with a prompt and we want an LLM to answer a question about something, we want to include also some semantic information about that. Like in your example about the book, you can say that this paragraph comes from this page comes from this chapter comes from this section, right? Mm-hmm. Just some sort of extra semantic information that will help LLM to give a better answer, right?
Yeah, and like, for example, when you do a template for your prompt, you can define the relations that are important. You can, for example, put it like a Cypher query as an example for one of the use cases. And since it has access to the whole of knowledge graph, it could make similar Cypher query to find information about its own use case.
It sounds like transfer learning. Is it the same idea used on relationship? So you mentioned embeddings, making embeddings from using LLM, right? So we kind of use the knowledge that is already in LLM to make embeddings?
I don't think so, because like in transfer learning, it's a lot of time when you are having some layers. So because like with these LLMs content, it's more of rogue, I would say, retrieval augmented generations, that you use the embedding, you use a model that exists and you try to do the embedding on them. And within the transfer learning, I think it's, if I look at it from window of deep learning, is always that you have a model, an architecture, and you try to transfer it from one data set to another data set. And that's in more of level of fine tuning, I would say.
So the reason I thought about the example I mentioned, like when there is a piece of text, and an example could be that this is the mother, or different, I don't know, relationship between things in text, and we want to ask an LLM to extract this graph. Because recently I was doing something a little bit similar. I had a piece of text, and I needed to create a JSON from this text. So I needed structure to give it some structure. And then, of course, instead of doing it myself, I just asked an LLM to do this. And ChatGPT did it pretty well. So that's why I thought maybe we can actually also use it for not just only extracting JSON from that, but also extracting relationship from texts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite, I have tested it a bit. Also, it's like with a lang chain, I would say, that it's kind of a tree of thoughts that you ask it question, it gives you some items and you go further down. The only tricky thing in that is a bit like you need setups to work, because if it is just a limited amount of questions and depths to work, I would say it's easy to check it. But when you want to extract a lot of content from your text, it's quite tricky to trust it. And a lot of time that knowledge graphs come with LLMs, it's exactly the opposite. You want to have something that you can trust. And that's why I think it's still the old process of building knowledge graph is required, because if you have it with LLM, you are in a loop. You can never validate it. Maybe it can help you, but still to verify it is quite tricky. And with ChatGPT, you can also see that if you ask it for an output today, it could have different kind of results after a while, or with a bit different content before. So the history of it is affecting on the answer that it's providing.
And right now I'm looking at one of your GitHub projects. So this project is called ADPT-LRN-FHYSES. I guess it's adaptive learning physics, right?
Yes, quite tricky name.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about this project?
Actually, it's interesting because it's quite connected to what we just discussed, because this was a bootcamp project. So like first time that I retried to for myself also to connect knowledge graph with LLMs. And that was the idea of thinking that like nowadays you can ask a lot of questions from GPT, and how it could be to have a platform or a code, piece of code that it can make you learning material. So, and our first target was to have it on physics, as it is with a lot of projects, you aim for something and you end up on something else. So, and that was exactly because we had just 2 weeks to finish this project. And then a lot of hallucination and untrustworthy of ChatGPT on generating the concept. So like how we were doing it, it was saying that, okay, so we had a lang chain with breaking down a topic, and we wanted to make knowledge graph for physics that you can provide material to users. So like first users comes and then you ask some questions about the interest, the levels and so on. And then it provides you step-by-step content, question and answer that supports you to learn a new domain. And that was the initial idea. But since it was building the knowledge graph really hard and really not good results out of ChatGPT 3.5 Turbo, and that's like when we decided to change the project a bit. And instead of having learning platform for physics, we moved it to support, still in a learning direction, but like supporting people to read papers. So like if you are not a researcher, or if you are a researcher, how we could have a platform that you give in a paper and it break it down to you, and it could support you with the same consequence that you feel comfortable to read paper in domains you have never read. And that was like breaking down the paper to the sections, find the relation of them, and also connect it to other papers and the references and so on. So like that was the final result of it.
I'm looking right now at visualization. So what happens there is that there's this part where you upload a file.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all you need in this example. So you drag it or you upload this. And then what it's doing, it's extracting text from the PDF and looks at different terms there, different words, right?
Yeah.
And then it builds a graph from these words and explains each of them, right? Or how does it work?
We have two tracks. So first tracks, it's like doing semantics. So it's like extract each sections of the paper, and then do embedding on them and finding the relations between them. Another track is that it get each section and use in some steps with GPT that what are the keywords for these sections, and then defining the keywords of them. So it's independent of the graph. So it's with several prompts to extract more knowledge. So then I think at the end of this, you see that when you hover over some keywords, it show you a small box that it's describing that. So it's more of having all in one place that you don't need to move around to read a paper. And also with these sections and this graph, when you like click on the edges of them, you can explode it and see what is common between two sections and what are the differences. And this is more interesting when you have two different papers, because for example, you want to compare the method development. When you click on the edge, it explodes and summarizes the differences and similarities of those ones. And this work is working only on archive papers, because really extracting semantic with PDF and getting these sections, it's not so simple. So because it could really differ how people are publishing and generating their PDF. And with archive, it's good that they always get in the text and generate it themselves. So it's more trustworthy to extract the PDF from them. And then what we do is that like when you also upload the paper, we could get all the references out and then make a summary of the paper and its references, and show what is, for example, the most relevant reference to that. Because also on visualization, we are using PageRank, that like this size of the nodes are referring on how important that node is in the whole network that you see. And then we could see that, okay, what is the most important reference within this domain? And this is a help a bit more for people who used to read papers, because for them, it's quite time-saving to find the most relevant related work to dive in.
I wish I had a tool like that when I was doing my master's. I was doing information retrieval on mathematics, on mathematical formula, and just like reading, especially at the beginning, like doing the state-of-the-art research, understanding what is there, and like reading just random papers that are potentially about the topic and then feeling completely lost there. Like, I think I would have been more effective with a tool like that. And I wished I had something like that. So I also wanted to mention that, like, I was taking a German test last week, and I was preparing for this German test. And there are so many grammar concepts that are related.
Mm.
Example, connectors, right? So there can be, connectors that connect sentences. Then there could be like some connectors there for how do you call them, dependent sentences. Sometimes these two sentences are independent, and sometimes the connectors are actually adverbs, not real connectors. Like, there are different sorts of connectors, and there are different sorts of different grammatical things. And for me, like, when I try to comprehend all that, this is just my mind blows. And having this graph structure where, you know, some sort of mind map where you can zoom in different concepts and see how they are connected could be quite useful. And I think, like, with a little bit of tweaking, if I understand correctly, this project can also do that, right?
Yes. I think, I mean, it's a lot of time with these finding relations. If it's rely on LLM, then it's like how well it's described and so on. But I think chunking all grammatic pieces into a node and then finding the relations between them, it could be a great start. Yeah. And for me, it's the same all the time. It's like learning new things needs to find the relations between them. And that helps to say, okay, this is the same as this one. And when you have no clue and just walk around, it's hard to summarize everything and learn it. And that's like the main reason, I think, we came here. But what was the first goal of the project was, I think, even more interesting in this direction, that you can have a chain of questions going down that really make a teaching material, I would say. And the reason we were calling it adaptive is that based on how is your pace of learning, these paths will differ, because I think people have different techniques or different preferences. And that, like, in this direction of instead of having one for all teaching processes, that the platform can learn you while providing more content for you. But the scope was too big for 2 weeks, I would say. Maybe later on we could work more on that.
What was the most difficult part in this project?
I think that we couldn't automate generating the graph. That was the biggest challenge. And then also to change the project topic to something that it's really tangible. So it's like not domain specific, that it will be interesting for people with no background of research and so on. Because that was one of the demands, to find a problem that matter for a lot of people.
Like, for example, if I think about something that is not related to research and has a lot of different complex relations between things, I think of Game of Thrones. Have you watched it?
Yes.
And like all these people who do different things, they're like, they belong to different houses and whatnot, right? And like, when you watch this and you think like, oh, what's happening there? Right. So having a graph there that explains what's going on would really be helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Or which people are in which chapters and like things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Was the deployment part also difficult? I see you used Fly.io, or it was something that...
Streamlit, it's... we had fun on the demo day. Streamlit didn't work. So it's like we deployed it on a Streamlit, and exactly at the time we started to show our demo live, Streamlit crashed. And I would say it's hard to develop with Streamlit when you go to more complex visualization. So I think if we go back, the graph was still okay, but like when you have a sequence of dynamics, so you click here, and so it's like mostly of state management and front-end development, because when you have a lot of dynamics and interconnections, then it's getting quite so much time consuming to solve these state within Streamlit. Still, it's great that it supports it, so you can do still quite complicated the visualizations, but it will take time.
Yeah, the interface is still pretty advanced from what I see. Like, there is a piece of text, and then you hover over a term, and then it explains what this term is. And I also see this graph structure, and then you can explore it, which is pretty impressive for a 2-week project. Super impressive.
I think it was we were two, so it was I wasn't alone, and we were both having experience in web development, and also the other team member, Jonathan, he had a great web development experience, and so together it was a lot to do, I would say, even though we failed on the first topic, so we lost some time. Still, I would say,
and it's part of the process, right?
Yeah.
Maybe, do you know any books or other resources for people to learn more about graph machine learning, knowledge graphs, and how LLMs can be used for that? I don't know if there are many books about LLMs yet, maybe not, but like in general, maybe there are some cool resources that you can recommend.
I never learn with books, so that's like that's quite a tricky thing to recommend, really. But I could recommend courses. So I really enjoyed the courses from Stanford for graph data science. And also recently Deep Learning AI, they had a really cool short course for knowledge graph and LLM. So I really find it inspiring. And within LLM, to be honest, I think it's still, I mean, to learn the basics, I like the course of Sebastian. It's not also yet complete, I think, because I really like the content he's contributing. I also don't remember his last name. Sorry, my memory is never super duper. I'm just trying to find the last name, but maybe I could give the full name later on. And I think that's quite looking interesting, I think, the material, because the repo is not complete yet for LLM either. More than that, it's always digging in and finding new content. So tricky to have it as a old-fashioned domain like mechanical engineering, that you read a book and you know it's all in, because it's I think it's part of learning is in this domain is to always have a head or ear out to look for new things. And also learning how to navigate with all of these informations, not to feel overwhelmed and still moving forward.
And the course from Stanford that you mentioned is called Machine Learning with Graphs, right?
Yes.
So by Jure Leskovets.
Yes.
He's quite a well-known person in the graph community, right?
Yeah. And I really also recommend to follow the Graph Conference that is he's taking care of it. And I think it has been so far a free conference to attend, because the research exchange there is really great.
Yeah, we should be wrapping up. That's all we have time for today. So thanks a lot, Anahita, for joining us today, for sharing your experience with us, answering all the questions. And thanks everyone for joining us today too, being active, asking questions too. So yeah, it was fun.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Yeah, see you around. And bye everyone.